Oh, I'm knocking stuff down already. I feel right at home. Okay. It feels like I've been gone forever, and I've been gone for only a week. It's just been, it's so neat to see. Some of you, I recognize your face, but it's been like 3.5 or 4 years since I've seen you. And so if you go, if I'm going, I know you, please forgive me and let me know your name again. It'll come flooding back. Happened at the men's retreat. All these guys were coming up, and they were, how you doing, and how your kids, and how's Verla, and how's Matt, and I'm going, I know this person. it was great. It took me about 15 minutes to remember everybody, but I'm just delighted to see that the Lord is blessing you. It does me good. It does my soul good to walk in here and just feel the affection that you have for one another. It confirms in me that God's leading me in the right way. So, and Gary has become a fast friend, and he and I call each other from time to time and kind of share our private struggles and help each other out. And so you minister to me even through him. Those of you who are at the men's retreat have heard this before. I spoke to the men last night on the entire Gospel of John. And so we're going to spend some time looking at the Gospel of John because I want to talk about the Gospel. I was reminded when Gary was talking about 9/11. In 2001, our daughter Amber had just graduated from USC and was getting married in the last few weeks of July. And it was a momentous time for us as a family because our youngest was getting married, and our son Matt and his wife Corinne were going to be headed toward New Jersey because my son had just graduated from Cal Poly, San Luis Obispo, with his master's, and he was going to go get his doctorate at Rutgers University in oceanography. And so it was a big deal for us because two of our, you know, our son and his wife were going 3,000 miles across the country, and they were going to live there, and they're still there. He's a professor at the University of Delaware right now, teaches oceanography, goes all over the world. I think I said before, his life is sort of a combination of Indiana Jones and a Flipper episode. It's a great life, you know. I said, son, you've got it made, you know. So anyway, we try to go vacation with him as much as we can. But he just got back from Antarctica. I tell you all kinds of mad stories. But the point was is that we had scheduled, John and Amber got married, and I did the ceremony, and then Matt and Corinne left literally from the wedding to drive to New Jersey. And we had planned to go out to the East Coast in the second week of October. And so when 9/11 hit, all of that got cast into doubt, and we weren't sure if we were going to go or not, or if even they were going to allow us to go back there. And some of you remember all of the chaos that ensued about how hard it was to travel and that sort of thing. But we did make the trip. And so one of the things we wanted to try to do is go into New York City and get as close to the World Trade Center as we could just to see with our own eyes what had happened. I mean, we didn't want to be intrusive and looky-loos, but we wanted to look up close and personal what this looked like, but we thought, well, they wouldn't let us anywhere near. They wouldn't let us within 30 blocks of it. So we said, okay, we're going to try to do the next best thing. And we went over to the Empire State Building and waited in line for 2.5 hours while they took away all your tiny little pocket knives and nail clippers and that sort of thing. And they finally, you know, they had security guards everywhere, but they were letting people to the top of the Empire State Building, and you could look across and see where the World Trade Center was not, which was sort of a strange sort of thing. So anyway, we finally got to the top there, and I ended up standing next to a New York City fireman. He was off duty, and he was volunteering, doing some security and whatnot, and I got to talking to him, he was telling me about how difficult it was down there and how many people had died and just sort of the horrors of the whole thing. And I noticed that there was sort of a haze that was raising up from where the World Trade Center was. And I wasn't quite sure what I was seeing. And a soft wind was blowing our way. And there was a strange smell that I'll never forget. And it smelled like sort of a mixture of sewage and rot, and it smelled like death. And I said to him, am I smelling what I think I am? He goes, you are. So that is the smell of death, and it's coming from that hole in the ground. Well, it wasn't a hole then, it was a pile of rubble. And this thought struck me, where it says in 2 Corinthians 1, to some, we are the aroma of life. And to some, the gospel is the aroma of death. And then Paul says, who is adequate for these things? And the obvious answer is nobody. We are not capable of managing the enormity of a disaster like that. It offends the senses. We reject it because we can't get our mind around the depth of that sort of tragedy. I remember talking to my son later, and he said, you know, we got here barely a month when that hit, and they could see the smoke from their house where they lived in northern New Jersey. And he said he was one of the very few Christians that was in that PhD program. And he said immediately, people knew he was a believer, and they came to him immediately, and they wanted to talk to him about the reality of evil. And he says, here I am, I'm a first-year PhD candidate, and, you know, what do I know? And he says, I've all the smartest people in the world coming to me wanting to know why this happened. When these sort of things happen in life, it is the gospel that brings clarity. And that's what I want to talk to you about this morning, is reminding us of the gospel. Paul said something really interesting to the Roman church. The church at Rome had already been established, but he said in the first chapter of Romans, he said, I've desired to come to you to preach the gospel to you. And you think, well, why is it that he's saying, I need to preach the gospel to you. I thought you were already believers. But I like what C.J. Mahaney says. He says, we have to keep preaching the gospel to ourselves, because it's just not a one-time deal you make with God and say, okay, I bought my fire insurance, and now I can go live, and God's a nice guy, and he'll keep forgiving me. The gospel is applicable to all of life, living gospel lives, and it is good for us to be reminded about what the gospel is, because we forget. We forget the gospel. And so this morning, I'm going to tell you again the gospel. Not because you don't believe. Maybe there are some of you who don't believe. Maybe there are some of you who think you believe, and maybe you don't. You didn't really understand it. Maybe some of you are going to hear the gospel for the first time. Let me say something to you that might shock you. We are not saved by what Jesus taught. We are not saved by what Jesus said. We are saved by what Jesus did. All the philosophy, all of the theology explains what Jesus did. But what he did saves us. And you have to understand the enormity of what he did. And Matt said to me, he said, you know what, Dad? I think the Lord brought me out here at this time to preach the gospel. Right now, he's a professor at University of Delaware, and it's one of the fastest-growing oceanographic, I'm bragging on my son, I always like to, but one of the fastest-growing oceanographic departments in the world, and he goes all over the world, and he has about 40 postdoctoral and PhD candidates that he's shepherding as his little church, coming to his Bible study every Tuesday night, And about every 2 weeks, another one comes to Christ. The university doesn't know what to do with it because they're getting a whole handful now of Christian students, and it's because Matt's just been faithful with teaching them the Word. What is the gospel? The Gospel of John is unlike all of the other gospels in this way. Matthew, Mark, and Luke are written as not only explanations of the life of Jesus, but also historical accounts. Now, I'm not saying that John isn't historical, but John is unique in the way it's laid together. Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Matthew, you'll notice that Matthew and Luke, they describe the birth and the infancy of Jesus. Matthew is written to the Jewish mind, demonstrating that Jesus is the King of the Jews, that he is the rightful heir, he is the Lord of the earth. Luke is written for the Gentile, the Greek mind, and he is laying out in consecutive order. You'll notice that Luke and Acts are a two-volume series, that he lays out in order not only what Jesus did and said, but then also the Acts of the Apostles and the establishment of the church. And it's written in a very Western style. It's for the logical and sequential mind. Mark is somewhat unique in the sense that it starts with the ministry of Jesus, and it's written to demonstrate that not only was Jesus the King of the Jews, he was the suffering servant that you find in Isaiah 40 to 55. That was the most perplexing part of the Bible for the Jewish mind, because they couldn't get their mind around the fact that Messiah had to die. And that is precisely how Mark describes Jesus, the Messiah who died and lived again. But John is different in the sense that John does not write merely from the historical point of view, though all of the things that he selects for his gospel are historical. John is a theological essay. It's a philosophical treatise. It is meant to make you think about the gospel in a different sort of way. He doesn't start at the birth of Christ. He starts in eternity past when he says, "In the beginning was the Word." And what he does is he selects certain features of the life of Christ, and he lays them forward to you sort of in sequence as evidence. And he is driving you to a point in the book where you have to make a choice. It's the greatest gospel tract ever written. That's why we give people the Gospel of John. Here, read this. And he is driving you to a point where you have to make a choice. And you have to say, either this is the most fantastic hoax ever perpetuated, or it is absolutely true. Look with me at John 20, and I'll show you where John is driving you. And he does it in a relentless fashion. John 20, verse 31. And let me give you a little bit of prep for this. John selects seven specific miracles from the life of Christ. And he starts with miracles that seem plausibly deniable. They're localized, they're sort of low in intensity. And he gives you seven miracles in order, each one with increasing intensity, improbability, more and more public so that they are undeniable. He starts with turning water to wine, and he ends with raising Lazarus from the dead. And he drives the reader to a point that says, you've got to make a choice. And so the question is, John, why did you select these? And John says, now Jesus did many other signs. This is verse 30 of chapter 20. In the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. He did a lot of other things that I didn't put in this book. So the obvious question is, well, why did you select these, John? Why these? He says, these are written, that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing, you may have life in his name. And the interesting thing there about the term for life, it is not just the term bios, which means biological life. It's the term zoe, which means personhood, personality, sentience. Early in John and later on in John 5, they describe the Father as being self-existent. We all have to live within a biological environment to live, which means that we have to have air and we have to have water and we have to have food and we have to have space to move around. That's biological life. But there's another ingredient to our life. It's our soul. This zoe, that is the self-existent life that God possesses. He doesn't need support. He is. It says in Hebrews 11, verse 6, one who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is as he is. That's the implied idea there. And that he is the rewarder of those who seek him. And so what John does is he starts by saying, I've given you these signs, and I've given you the account of what we did to him for one reason. You may believe and that you might have life. It's an amazing journey that he takes you, and I'm going to show it to you because you need to understand the gospel. I'm not saying you don't believe. I think you do. But I want to give you confidence in a world that rejects the gospel. To them, it's an aroma of death. But to those who believe, it's the aroma of life. In 328 BC, Thales of Ionia became the father of the modern era. You're saying, wait a minute. Did the modern era start in 328 BC? How is that possible? Well, they didn't know it was the modern era, but it was. We seem to think that the modern era started around the 1920s or the 1930s when things like refrigerators and washing machines and television sets and air conditioners began to show up. These so-called modern appliances. It started far before that. Modernism, and by the way, we live in what's called a postmodern world. I read an article last year by Vaclav Havel, who said that the modern era ended in 1980, and he's right. We now live in postmodern world, which I think gives us enormous possibilities and opportunities for the gospel. But we'll talk about modern. What does that mean? It's from the Latin word modo, which means to measure. What Thales figured out in 328 BC is when he was looking up in the sky and he saw an eclipse of the sun. And back then, the pagans thought, well, the gods were angry, so they were eating the sun, or they were turning the lights out, or you know, whoever knew what was the reason why this happened. But he was a mathematician and a philosopher, and he figured out by mathematical calculation that there was going to be an eclipse. And when it happened, suddenly, the entire world changed. Western culture was born because they realized that we could predict, based on natural reason and rational thought, why things happen, that we could measure it. And that is how our society came to be. It's the problem-solution approach to life. If there's something wrong, we need to trace it back, and we need to figure out what contributed to it, and we need to find out where it went wrong, correct the trajectory of the facts, and then the problem will be solved. But what it assumes is that the human mind is omnicompetent, that there is nothing that the human mind cannot comprehend. That is called modernistic philosophy. That means it is the assumption that no matter what it is, no matter how fantastic, no matter how inexplicable it seems, given enough time and the ability to gather data, we can find the answer and we can control it. Now, it's that philosophy that made Western society possible. It's that philosophy that made science possible. So that's a good thing. But there's one assumption that human beings make, is that the human mind is capable of everything. And so around the time of the Enlightenment, and you've heard about the Enlightenment, rationalistic philosophers, by the way, there's nothing wrong with being rational, and there's nothing wrong with being logical. We all use reason. You've heard common sense, right? You've heard the term common sense. All it means is that we have a problem-solution approach to things. That's what it means. So anyway, what happens is that modern people think they can get their minds around everything, and so when they looked at the Bible, they said, there are miracles in here. We know miracles can't happen. So the Bible must be a myth. They started with their answer, and then they proved it by their supposed facts. That is what the so-called Enlightenment did for us, and we find that in modernistic philosophy today, and that's made its way into our schools to say, miracles can't happen, there is no God out there, science is our God. If we can't find the answer, there is no answer, or we just don't know what it is yet. In 1980, that all changed. Because now what's happening in the science of the very, very small, in physics, as they get smaller and smaller and smaller down into quantum physics, they're finding that it's becoming more and more complex, not more and more simple. And as they get into the larger part of the universe, black holes, string theory, I read a book by Kip Thorne on that recently, they're finding out that it's more and more complex. Some are saying that there may be as 11 different planes of existence. This is what naturalistic science is telling us. And they're finding out it's too complex. We can't get our mind around it. But in a societal way, and this is what Vaclav Havel said, the final end of humanistic society, who says that the solution to all of our problems is government, or solution to our problems is money, or solutions to our problems are education, it all came crashing down with the collapse of the Soviet Empire. That is the end result of humanistic philosophy. And they realized that there was one factor that they could not comprehend. Number one, when we look at the world around us, we realize there's something wrong with the world. Things go wrong, and we don't know why. And then not only that, they say, there's something wrong with me. Why is it that I can't control myself and do the things I know that I should do and ought to do? That's bad news. The postmodern society has lost any confidence in human beings. The breakdown of our political system is not because of our lack of facts, it's because of our lack of confidence in people. When I went to graduate school, and those of you who went to graduate school when I did, we didn't have computers. We did all of our papers on typewriters. We went into the stacks and we got information out and we wrote it down by hand. The issue back in the 60s and 70s and 80s is that we didn't have information. But now we have all the information we need. And the problem is, the question is, who's telling the truth? And so what's happened now is that people have started to go back to paganism, just like they did prior to 328 BC. Have you ever noticed all the emphasis on superheroes and vampires and witches and all of those things has all gotten very, very popular? That is the sign of the postmodern society. It doesn't matter anymore if it's true. It doesn't matter if it's measurable. If it just has some sort of an effect on me, then it's true for me. But things that are true or not true are based on whether or not they correspond with reality. If you're driving down Highway 29 and you come to a red light and say, you know, that doesn't comport with my reality. I want to pretend that it's green and you go through the red light, what's going to happen? You're going to suffer a consequence, right? Hopefully it's only getting a ticket, but you might get T-boned and put into the hospital in Santa Rosa. Truth matters. So the question is, how does the gospel affect this? John does an amazing job by saying, I'm going to demonstrate to you in a factual and logical way that the gospel is just not about relieving my psychic pain. It's just not about whether or not I have meaning in life. It's something that's true, and it needs to be presentable because it is the solution to the foundational problem of man, and we call that sin. John starts with this, believe it or not, I will have you out on time. John starts with this prologue in verses 1 to 18 and says this, Jesus is the God of the universe. He existed before all time began. The world did not start from some preexistent singularity. It did not start from chance. In order to have chance, you have to have mass, you have to have space, and you have to have motion. The Big Bang Theory tells us that you had only one of those things, and it wasn't measurable. There was no mechanisms for chance, so the chance is exactly zero. Instead, there was an intelligence called God. The Greeks called him the Logos. The Logos was what they believed to be all of perfection, all of beauty, all of symmetry in one being, but the Greeks believed we can't find him. We live in a shadow world. Plato said that. And so John blew the Greek mind, and this is written in 85 from Ephesus. And so John was very familiar with Greek culture, and he says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And in verse 14, he says, and the Word became flesh. How can you have a being who is both 100% God and 100% man? Is he not a 200% person? No. How do you explain it? I don't know how he did it. I only know that he did it. Well, how do you know that he did it? Keep reading, because then he displays to you seven miracles for which there are no explanation. He says this. First, he talks about the testimony of John the Baptist, how he was predicted. And then he shows up at a wedding in Cana of Galilee. And he turns water to wine. And if you'll note, he says in verse 11 of chapter 2, this is the first of his signs Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed. Then he went down to Capernaum. And then he went to Jerusalem. He cleansed the temple and he provoked the religious system on purpose to show them that he indeed was God. He finds a man named Nicodemus and says, Nicodemus, what your problem is not your theology. Your problem is your heart. You must be born again. But God loved the world and sent his only Son that if you believe, you'll live forever. Nick couldn't understand it. He then finds a woman in Samaria, full of sin, rejected, destitute. and tells her he's the solution to her problem of sin. He goes back to Cana of Galilee, and a temple official comes to him and says, 20 miles away, my son is dying. Jesus, can you do something about it? Jesus says, he's healed. The official goes back. Jesus does a long-distance miracle. He manipulates space and time. How did he identify who that kid was and where he was and what his specific disease was and what was the cure needed? And when they compared the times, how did he do this? Again, the miracle gets a little bit more intense. And then he goes down to Jerusalem and he finds a person who's been crippled for 38 years. If you had not used your legs for 38 years, what would they look like? And Jesus heals him. And he does it on the Sabbath just to irritate the Jews. And so when they come to complain, they said, by what authority did you do this? He says, well, let me tell you about authority. What is the root word of the word authority? Author. Jesus said, that's me. They didn't like that. Well, how did he do that? I'm the author. And by the way, since I'm the author, one day I will judge every one of you. And the face of that judge that you will see will be mine. You will stand before me and answer for your life. You ask 99% of the people on this planet, will you answer for what you've done in this life, and what will they tell you? Yes. No matter what religion they are, they'll tell you yes. And if you say, you want to know who the judge will be? His name is Jesus of Nazareth. Then what he does, he goes to a place that's absolutely desolate, has no resources whatsoever, no food, no water, and he produces food for 5,000 people. So much that it's left over, and the people say, oh, let's make him the political king. It looks like he can heal people, he can raise dead people, he can produce food. Those are all the things that an army needs to defeat the Romans. Let's go ahead and make him king. Let's worship you. And Jesus says, I didn't come for that. I came to die on purpose. And so he leaves them, and he does his next miracle. His disciples can't figure out why he did something like that, and they're out in the middle of the Sea of Galilee, and suddenly comes strolling along the surface of the Sea of Galilee comes Jesus walking, manipulating space and time and matter. Who is the only being who can do that? God. And you see the increasing intensity of these miracles that John is laying forth for you. And then he tells them, you want to know what that whole feeding of the 5,000 thing was? I'm the bread of life. I'm the bread from heaven. Remember the manna thing where people had no resources in the desert? They had no water. They had no food. How did you feed 2 million people? I was the one that sent the manna. That was me. He then shows up at the Feast of Booths and tells everyone, I'm the solution to your problem. From me, if you believe in me, from your innermost being, rivers of living water will flow. The Holy Spirit will flow out of you, which was a new thought. They send officers to arrest Jesus now because he's creating a political stir. And they come back and said, we couldn't arrest him because no one has spoken like this man has spoken. Jesus forgives a woman caught in adultery that they had set up to try to accuse him. And they fail. And then he tells them, you are of your father, the devil. And before Abraham even existed, I am the eternal God. And then Jesus does something amazing. He goes down publicly and he finds a man that everyone knows has been born blind. And on the Sabbath, just to provoke the confrontation, he takes a little bit of dirt and he works on the Sabbath by making little mud balls. And he puts it on this guy's eyes and he makes this guy work on the Sabbath by washing the mud out of his eyes. And when he's done washing it out of his eyes, he can see. And everybody knew that this guy had been born blind. How did he do it? And what they do is they complain about Jesus because he did it on the Sabbath. And he says, I'm in charge of the Sabbath. I'm not only in charge of the Sabbath, I am the good shepherd. As opposed to the bad shepherds that you know about in Ezekiel 34. And then the final and seventh miracle. He waits while his good friend Lazarus dies. And then publicly in front of all of the seeing eyes of Jerusalem, out in the little town, he stands in front of the grave and he calls out, Lazarus, come forth. And it says, and he came. And we are finally now to the crisis moment, because this is just before Jesus is crucified. Look with me at chapter 11, verse 47. So the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered, and the council said, what are we to do? For if this man performs, many signs. If we let him go on like this, what presumptive arrogance. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him. And here is the money line. And the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. There it is. It was all about power. Political power. It's all what it was about. It doesn't matter that he's demonstrated who he is. It's about our power. We have to kill him. He's left us no choice. What presumptive arrogance. Jesus knows this immediately, that he is intentionally, by the signs that he has done, provoked a confrontation, and he knows that he is in charge and he is in control of the entire process. And so they take him before the most sophisticated theological court in the world, the Sanhedrin. And they are inadequate to judge. They said, well, are you the Son of God? And he says, yes. And they said, you can't say that. He says, look at what I've done. Who can do these things but God? And so they beat him. And they cannot come up with a charge. And so they say, since we can't kill him, only the Romans can do this, we're going to take him to the Romans and get the Romans to do it. And so they take him in front of the Romans, and Pilate comes out and says, what's the charge? Their response, if he were not an evil man, we would not have brought him to you. Every judge in Lake County would throw you out of court if you said that. There is no charge. We just don't like him, and we want you to kill him. This is the heart. This is the problem of the heart of man. It's about who has the power. This is the essence of sin. It's the problem. And Jesus, by provoking the confrontation with sinful man, is going to solve that very problem. He will be crucified at the hands of wicked men in order that he might release them from their wickedness. No one could think of that but God. And so he is taken before the judges of the most just society of the world, the Romans, the most sophisticated religion and the most just secular government. Pilate says, I find no guilt in this man. That was an official declaration. Not guilty, crucify him. Kill him. The most sophisticated religion in the world, the most sophisticated justice system in the world, both declared him not guilty, both sentenced him to death. And so they took him and they crucified him. Completely innocent. Declared innocent. And he died, and he did it on purpose. He was buried. His death was verified, and John in his affidavit says, the Roman soldier even came and slid a spear underneath his rib cage and ran it up and pierced the ventricle of his heart so that he was sure he was dead. And it was demonstrated by the water and the fluid and the blood that had accumulated in his thoracic cavity, and it showed that he was dead. He could not have been living. He was embalmed. He was buried in a tomb, a guard of 16 Roman soldiers who, on pain of death, had to guard. And if they left their posts or fall asleep, they would be killed. An angel came and rolled away the stone, scattered the guards. And he rose from the dead. And he appeared to Mary. He appeared to the disciples. And he appeared to Thomas, the doubter, who says, I want empirical evidence. I want to see the holes. I want to put my hand in them. Within 100 years of that event, the gospel had spread to India, to Central Africa, north to Europe, to Denmark, in that area, north to Russia, all the way to Spain. Not enough time for mythology to have been developed. Not enough time. There was no explanation for the establishment of the church of the first century, because that many people could not be persuaded that an obvious hoax was true. The eyewitnesses believed, and they told others, and through the power of the Holy Spirit, more believed, and started a chain that is found its way to here, that you believed. And you are part of the same story, and you are charged to tell people what Jesus did to deliver you, and how they can be delivered.